Well, let me welcome all of you to Amplified Live. Amplified is what we believe to be the world's largest social network dedicated to changing the world for the better, filled with thousands of healthcare practitioners, chiropractors, and other natural healthcare providers that are really dedicated to making a positive difference in the world. And today we have the, honor to speak with now New York Times best-selling author, Dr. Joe. Your most recent book, You Are the Placebo, Making Your Mind Matter, hit the New York Times bestseller list, am I to understand, in a week, less than a week, some incredible feat? Is that the case?
Yeah. It became a bestseller in New York Times in about a week, yeah, so pretty exciting.
That's fantastic. Not an easy thing to do, and I think it just sort of is a testament to how hungry we are as a world to understand really the possibilities. We're living, I think most of us would agree, in a healthcare system, in a world that desperately needs, I'll say, a higher level of consciousness, higher level of awareness, and more specifically, you know, some specific answers that may transcend what we've been doing and the way we've been thinking for quite a while. For those that don't know Dr. Dispenza, I'll just give a brief history. This is not your first book, of course. You wrote Evolve Your Brain, The Science of Changing Your Mind, and Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. I think all obviously based on your neuroscience training at Rutgers. Why don't we start off by, if you'd share, you know, you had a pretty amazing personal experience that sort of led you down this pathway, to give everybody sort of a little bit of background as to kind of who you are and how you came upon this. Maybe we can start there.
Sure. I'd love to. Well, it was 1986. I was living in Southern California, and I think, you know, in order for some of us to wake up, we need a wake-up call, and that was my wake-up call. I was in a triathlon in Palm Springs. I was on the biking portion of the race, and I was coming up to this turn, and I was going to negotiate a turn around these two cyclists, and there was a police officer on the corner. And he had his back to the oncoming traffic, but he was pointing at me, and I was locked in on him, you know, visually. I just was looking at him, and he was instructing me to make the turn and to merge past these two bikers. Well, as I made the turn, because he had his back to the oncoming traffic, the moment I turned onto the new street, there was a four-wheel drive Bronco going about 55 miles an hour, and I got hit from behind and catapulted out of my bicycle, and I landed pretty hard on my back, and when you land very strongly on your spine, either on your butt or on your back, there's a compressive force, and as most people know on the call, the compression pushes the limits of the vertebral columns, and so I wound up fracturing 6 vertebrae in my spine. It was T8, T9, T10, T11, T12, and L1. And when you break a volume of a vertebrae down, like you can't be pancake, the volume has to go somewhere. So it goes back towards the spinal cord, depending on how you land. And the eighth thoracic vertebrae, the top vertebrae, took the majority of the force, and it compressed more than 60%. And the neural arch broke like a pretzel. So I had bone fragments on the cord, and I had pressure on the cord because the neural arch was contained, you know, up against the spinal cord. So prognosis wasn't very good, I was facing paralysis, and of course the next procedure is the Harrington rod procedure. So 4 opinions from 4 of the leading surgeons in Southern California, and everybody without a doubt said you need the Harrington rods. And for those people who don't know what Harrington rod surgery is, they basically do carpentry. They cut off the back parts of your vertebrae. And in my case, it would be from the base of my neck to the base of my spine. And they put these stainless steel rods in the spine, and they screw them into the bodies of the vertebrae. And when they screw them in, it cantilevers and pulls the fractured areas away from the cord to create stability. And so they put one on each side, and then they take bone fragments from your hip, and they paste it over the top, and they hope for the best. Now, I think, you know, if it was a patient of mine and I saw the scans and I saw the x-rays, I probably would have said, look, you know, your best bet is to go ahead with the procedure. But this was me, you know, and I just couldn't rush to the most conventional choice. And so I think the worst of human suffering is indecision. I had to weigh what I knew against what was possible. And, the power that made the body heals the body, that just kept ringing for me over and over again, over and over again. And I thought, well, if this innate intelligence within us is an intelligence, it's a consciousness, and consciousness is an awareness, and awareness is paying attention, and now I'm not going anywhere and I'm not doing anything, I'm pretty much laying face down and I'm in trouble. Well, I'm going to decide on two things. The first thing is I'm not going to have the surgery, and I'm going to develop a relationship with this intelligence. I'm going to be present with it. And just like you're present with your husband or your wife or your kids or your coworkers, you know when people are present with you and when they're not, because their attention is on you. And I figured I would give it all of my attention, and I would give it a plan, a template, a design, something that I wanted. And then I would surrender my creation to this greater mind and allow it to do the healing for me. So that was the first thing. And the second goal I had was not to let any thought slip by my awareness that I didn't want to experience. Sounds really easy, but when you're in crisis and when you're in trauma, when you're facing some type of a serious condition, I became very aware that we focus on what we don't want instead of what we do want. So it became a very, very strong challenge for myself, because I realized, number one, how unfocused I was, and number two, how I couldn't stay present in the moment. And that, of course, made me more frustrated, which then drove my attention span further away from the midline. So I went through 6 weeks of hell, Jason, just trying to get my mind to work in the direction I wanted it to. And I would be reconstructing my spine vertebrae per vertebrae. The next thing you know, I'd lose my attention, and I'd be thinking about living the rest of my life in a wheelchair. Or I'd start reconstructing my spine, and then I'd think about, should I sell my practice? Should I sell my home? And then I would stop and start all over again. It would take me hours to get through one complete reconstruction. But 6 weeks of this torment and trying to make connection, I went through the entire rehearsal at the end of 6 weeks without losing my attention. And when I did that, something clicked. It just felt right. It was like I clicked on some level. And I started to notice that from that point forward, what took me 2 or 3 hours to do, I was able to do in a very short amount of time. And all of a sudden, I started to notice that I started feeling better. My body started. I had more sensation in my legs. I had just much less pain in my body. And I started to correlate what I was doing inside of me with the effects that were happening outside of me. And now I started to get really passionate. So that's the moment that I turned the battleship around. And I didn't know what I was doing at the time, but now I had all this extra time in my hands, because what took me 2 or 3 hours to do, I was doing in much less time. So I said, well, gosh, I would just love to see a sunset again. You know, I mean, I lived on the beach in San Diego, and I was too busy to even enjoy the sunset. Or started thinking about taking a shower again and standing up and never take it for granted, or sitting with my friends at lunch and having lunch and enjoying myself. And I didn't know that I was selecting potentials in the quantum field, and then I was emotionally embracing those possible realities. And your body is your unconscious mind, so it doesn't know the difference between the experience that produces the emotion and the emotion that you fabricate by thought alone. So my body, as the unconscious mind, began to believe it was living in that future reality in the present moment, and I started signaling new genes in new ways, and boy, in a very short amount of time, I got well really fast. And well, in 10 weeks, I was back on my feet. They wanted to cast me in a body cast and told me I'd have to wear it for 6 months to a year. I put the body cast on when I stood up that day and took it off 5 minutes later, and then pretty much walked back into my life and was back seeing patients at 12 weeks. And I just made a deal with myself that if I was ever able to walk again, if I was ever able to turn, you know, this condition into something where I was healthy again, I would spend the rest of my life studying the mind-body connection and mind over matter. That's what I've been doing since 1986.
Now, you had you are a neuroscientist, so you obviously had a deep understanding of the anatomy, the physiology of traditional science. I guess, how would you contrast what traditional science has said versus what you've discovered with your research and experience over the years?
Well, that's a great question, and it's not something that's we can give in a very easy way, but I do know that there are some very strong components that if you are looking at how mind affects matter or how your mind-body works, then you have to understand what mind is, and you have to begin to understand where our attention is, and we have to begin to break down the very process of thinking intellectual thoughts and producing emotions that go along with it. So when I got back on my feet, I couldn't go back to my life as the same person. You know, I mean, I was just initiated, and I mean, what was I going to complain about? I had to move on. So I became very passionate about studying spontaneous remissions, and so I interviewed many, many people that were diagnosed with health conditions and turned their diseases around. You know, it's so funny because anything that's considered a miracle or something unusual happens outside of convention, whether it's social convention or scientific convention or, you know, political convention, something that happens outside of our current beliefs. And so when I started looking at spontaneous remissions, I realized that they weren't so spontaneous after all, that there was a huge element of mind that people were managing their inner states really well in. They believed that there was an intelligence that was giving them life, and that they could instruct it and begin to interact with it and then surrender to it, and that they understood that it was the mismanagement of their own emotional states, their own anger and frustration or 20 years of guilt, that really was the thing that began to signal the disease to become active. So they had to break the habit of being themselves. They had to look at their habituations of thought, and they had to pay attention to their actions that were unconscious and what they said, and look at the emotions that kept them anchored to the past. And that process is, in neuroscience, is called metacognition. The fact that we can observe how we're feeling, the fact that we can pay attention to how we're acting, and we can think about what we're thinking, means we could modify our states of being to do a better job in life. And that process is the restraint or the inhibition that is connected to the old self. And when we do that properly, our biology begins to respond to our mind. In other words, when you go from the old self to the new self, when you decide to no longer think, act, or feel the same way, you're no longer firing and wiring the same circuits in your brain, and you're no longer emotionally signaling the same genes in your body in the same way, and the body goes into stasis. So I saw people that really decided to heal themselves of conditions that they had to look at their old identity, their old personality. And, you know, your personality creates your personal reality. That's it. And your personality is made up of how you think, how you act, and how you feel. So the present personality who's listening on this call has created the present personal reality called their life, which means if you want to create a new personal reality, then you got to become conscious of your unconscious thoughts and change them. Become aware of your habits and behaviors and change those, and look at the emotions that you've memorized and decide if those emotions belong in your future. See, I think most people try to create a new personal reality as the same personality, and it doesn't work. We literally have to become someone else. So I saw people, common people, doing unconventional things because they no longer were being the same person. And when they truly changed their state of being, when they reinvented themselves, they became somebody else. There was biological and neurological changes in their brain, and there were genetic changes in their body. And the disease existed in the old personality. It no longer existed in the new personality because they became somebody else. And because of the latest science in neuroplasticity and epigenetics, it was the perfect model that helped to explain really what I was seeing in common people. They didn't know what they were doing, but it was happening to them. So the science that I was studying and what I looked at became the contemporary model of mysticism. It became the way for me to explain what was unexplainable, and that we come preloaded with all the biological and neurological machinery to do this. And when people really make up their mind to change, there are significant and fundamental effects that are created. And so I wrote that next book, Evolve Your Brain, because I wanted people to understand that there is a science to changing your mind, and I really dispel the myth of disease and give people the understanding that they can change it. And the most common reason that people wind up sick, and 9 out of 10 people in the Western world wind up in a healthcare facility, is because they're walking in there because of a stress-related disorder, and that stress is a psychological stress. That means that they are angry or upset or they're frustrated or they're in fear, and it's the long-term effects of the hormones of stress that really begin to activate and signal the wrong genes in the wrong ways. So, And if you can think about a problem in your life that makes you feel that emotion, and it's a scientific fact that the hormones of stress make you sick, then for the most part, our thoughts can make us sick. So if our thoughts can make us sick, can our thoughts make us well? And that's where people start to become aware that they can really make significant changes for themselves. So that's what got me started in really asking bigger questions.
Yeah, and it's almost ironic that it's somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if I understand what you're saying correctly, if you believe in a limited model and you think of that as your reality, well, therefore, it is. But at the same time, what I'm also hearing you say, if I understand, is that if you believe in a reality of possibility, of potential, and be proactive to having your mind work for you as opposed to be reactive to what your experience says and then taking that on as your identity, you're right either way. Is that true?
It is, and let's talk about that, because your brain is organized to reflect everything you know in your life. Your brain is a record of the past. It's an artifact. It's a reflection of your external environment from all the things you've learned and all the things that you've experienced. By the same means, experience then produces emotion. So then the end product of an experience is how you feel. So if you're feeling the same way every single day, it means nothing new is happening in your life. And if those feelings are driving your thoughts, then for the most part, you're thinking in the past. And so most people define themselves as a memory of the past. They tell you the people they know, the things they do, the places they live, the things they own, at different times in their life. And so their autobiographical self is connected to a memory of the past. So if you're not creating anything new in your life, and you get up and do the same thing as you always do, and you see the same people, and you go to the same places at the exact same time, and you're consciously or unconsciously reacting to every known thing in your external environment, then it's no longer that your personality is creating your personal reality. Now your personal reality is creating your personality. You're victim to your external circumstances. And as long as you're reacting in the known familiar ways, consciously in thought or unconsciously in thought, that lead to the same choices, that lead to the same behaviors, that create the same experiences, that produce those same emotions, then for the most part, you're living in your past. So then if you do the same thing the next day, then, well, your biology and your neural circuitry and your hormonal expression and your chemistry and your neurotransmitters and even your genetic expression will stay the same, because there's no new information coming in from the environment. So then if you teach people then to have a vision of the future, and I don't care what vision that is. I don't care if it's being 25 pounds lighter. I don't care if it's having a wonderful, successful practice or a balanced life or a healthy relationship. Well, the moment they start to ask the question, what would it be like to have this or to be that, the frontal lobe begins to turn on, the crowning achievement of the human being. That's the workshop. That's 40% of your brain. And because the frontal lobe is connected to the rest of the brain, it looks out over the landscape of the brain, and it begins to select different networks of neurons of the things you've learned in your past, but this time, in the experiences that you had, it seamlessly pieces them together in a new way. It makes them fire in new sequences and new patterns and new combinations, and you're creating a new mind. Now you have vision. That's called intention. Now, people who are truly passionate then, when they begin to get a vision of the future, and they begin to get in touch with what it would feel like. They get inspired. They get overjoyed. They move into a state of gratitude. Now, the moment they begin to feel that elevated emotion combined with a clear intention, now their brain is no longer a record of the past. Now, in fact, it is a map to the future. And if you can bring up that elevated emotion, then your body, as your unconscious mind, is getting a taste of the future. And you're literally signaling new genes in new ways, so your body begins to change to look like the future event has occurred. Now, here's the cool part. I can tell you this from watching it for many years. When there's physical evidence in your brain and body that looks like the experience has already happened, this is when you can relax, because this is when the experience finds you, and it always comes in a way that you least expect, that surprises you, that leaves no doubt that what you did inside of you produced some result outside of you. That's the beauty behind all of this, because if you can expect it, it's nothing new. It's got to catch you off guard. So when you're defined by a vision of the future instead of the memory of the past, you're stepping from the known familiar self into the unknown. And when you and I are in the unknown, when we are outside of our familiar boundaries, that's when the miraculous happens. It can't happen in the known, because the known is everything that we already expect. A miraculous event is when you expect something that's unexpected. So getting people to step into that river of change from the old self to the new self, for most people it requires crisis or trauma or disease or diagnosis. It takes some type of loss for people to finally wake up and look at themselves. God, I've been thinking this way. God, look at how I've been speaking. Look how I've been acting. God, I've been living by these emotions. But my message is, why wait? You know, you can learn and change in a state of pain and suffering, or you can learn and change in a state of joy and inspiration. And I think people around the world now are really waking up to the fact of, for the latter, and that's where new levels of healthcare begin to become way more possible for people to embrace.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely fascinating. For those that have joined us late, and just to clarify as well my intentions, I mean, believe me, I'd love to speak with you for many, many hours about this because it's a fascinating topic. There's so much in your book that is mind-blowing, but also gives sort of a history in the background of experience of how people lived this and experienced it. You know, when you talk about the knee surgery that never happened or the heart surgery that wasn't and those types of things, it's amazing. For this call specifically, so what I'm saying is if you haven't read the book, you should go get it. I've read it. It's amazing. But for this call specifically, to sort of continue with where you were going just a moment ago, how do we do it? You know, we hear change yourself. And obviously when you have a crisis or some, I guess I'll call it unexpected event, which at this point now seems like it was something that happened perhaps because of your consciousness of the past and so on. You know, it's one thing to have a wake-up call. It's another thing that you don't want to wish upon a crisis, a healthcare crisis or something like that upon everybody to have, you know, this shift happen. How do we do it ourselves? And perhaps even more importantly, how do we use this as good parents to steward the future?
Well, this is a great conversation, Jason. Well, let's answer it on two levels, okay? Because the first level is, wow, what a great time to be alive. This is an amazing time because I understand that medicine works really well for acute care. I mean, you break your arm or you have appendicitis, you go for acute care. But when we're talking about chronic conditions, it requires a lifestyle change. And so how do we do it? Everybody already knows how to do this. We innately know what it takes in order to change. Think about it. Anybody who's ever done anything great on this call, and I'm assuming that everybody has done something great that they're proud of, the moment they decided to do something great, they had a vision of what they wanted. And they became possessed by that vision. They began to become inspired by it. They saw that future as a reality, and they came out of the resting state. Now, the moment they came out of the resting state, the emotion that they were experiencing is really your body getting a sampling of what the future is going to be like. So when you combine a clear intention with an elevated emotion, we call that a state of being. Thoughts are the language of the brain, and feelings are the language of the body. And how you think and how you feel creates a state of being. So for a moment, that person is living in that future, and their brain and body are reflecting it because there's circuitry that's reorganizing, and there's emotions beginning to signal new genes because it's new information. So when you make that kind of decision now, you move into a new state of being, but then you got your behaviors to match your intentions. You decided the things that you were not going to do, the thoughts you weren't going to think that got you in trouble, the choices you were no longer going to make. The hardest part about change is not making the same choice. You begin to look at the emotions that you look forward to that are connected to the same redundant experience. And the more conscious you become of your unconscious self, the more you won't go unconscious again. So there's a reviewing process that people naturally go through in the process of change. They say, I'm not going to eat this. I'm going to get up early. I'm going to do this. I know my body's going to not like it, but I'm going to do it anyway, and I'm going to give my absolute best. And then I'm going to make these choices, and I'm going to do these things. And you begin to review of who you no longer want to be, and you begin to review who you do want to be. And every day, you remember that vision. And it's on your mind the entire time. And you now are uncomfortable and it feels unfamiliar, but you keep going because you believe in that destiny. Now, everybody on this call has done something great like that, because When you get your behaviors to match your intentions, you're going to walk into a new reality. That's the bottom line. But you have to keep reproducing that same state of being every day until it becomes familiar and natural. When it becomes familiar and natural, then you're no longer investing your energy in the old self. You're taking your attention and your energy and you're putting it into a future. So you're pulling your energy out of the experience of the old self, and you're driving your energy, your thoughts and your intentions and your attention into a new self. Now, you do that enough times and you make the right choices, you're going to have exactly what you want. However, if you think about a time in your life where you said you were going to do something and you didn't accomplish it, what happened? You saw the vision and then all of a sudden you got busy. Time got in the way. You had too many social engagements. You had too much going on. You had an emotional reaction to somebody in your life, and the emotion clouded your vision of the future because the emotion is a record of the past. So how could you see the future if the emotion is becoming the lens of the past? And so you got frustrated, you got emotional, and then you start going back to doing the same things over again. You start making the same choices, and sooner or later the vision disappeared. And so then if you understand that that's what it takes, then if every day you woke up in the morning and you decided the thoughts and behaviors and emotions that kept you connected to the old self, and you were going to become conscious of them. Why? Because 95% of who we are by the time we're 35 years old is a set of memorized behaviors and emotional reactions, beliefs, perceptions, attitudes that function like a subconscious computer program. That's science telling us that. So 5% of your conscious mind is going against 95% of what we've memorized. And so in order for us to make a change then, we have to go into the operating system and just begin to pluck out those thoughts, those behaviors, those choices, those emotions that keep us anchored to the old self. The more aware we are of it, the less unconscious we become. And if you decide what thoughts you do want to believe in, and you begin to plan and think about your behaviors that day, the mere fact that you're thinking about and rehearsing in your mind the behaviors or the actions that you're going to make or the choices you're going to demonstrate, the process of mental rehearsal installs the circuitry in your brain. Now you've primed your brain so that it's warmed up and you're more prone to get your behaviors to match your intentions. And if you are a quantum mind and you begin to teach your body emotionally what that future event is going to feel like before it's manifested, and you understand then when your body begins to get the emotional signal, it's changing to bring you to that future event, and you're able to do that every day, sooner or later, it's going to become more easy and more familiar to you. So it takes a little bit of repetition in the beginning, but once we disinvest our energy out of the past and we keep investing our energy into the future, and our brain and body starts working together, that's the moment we start to experience the flow, the magic, the wonderful things that happen in our life. Now, that's the simplistic model when it comes to what we already innately know. Now, what about the patient? What about the person who's struggling in their life and they have to make substantial changes? Well, those people, they have to admit that when you're out of balance, and that's what stress is when your body's knocked out of homeostasis. The stress response is what your body innately does to return itself back to order. That if you're reacting to things in your environment that are turning on the primitive hormones of stress, those hormones work really well for the short term. But if you keep turning on those same reactions to the same conditions in your environment, those stress hormones long term knock the body out of balance permanently. And now we begin to notice symptoms, but the body's already beyond order. So what do you do if there's three types of stress, physical, chemical, and emotional? Then there's three ways to create balance, physically, chemically, and emotionally. So you get adjusted. You get your nervous system tuned up again. You start exercising again. You start doing deep breathing. You start eliminating certain foods. You stop overeating. You start taking your vitamins again. You start expressing love instead of fear. You start becoming aware of your emotional states. And if you do that properly, the body will naturally recalibrate itself. So if 9 out of 10 people walk into a healthcare facility in the Western world because of a psychological stress disorder, then we may not always be able to manage all the conditions in our external environment, but we can certainly manage our internal environment. And this is what we call emotional intelligence, to be able to have a stimulus, but instead of react, there's a gap, there's a pause. That pause is filled with possibility. But if you can't wait when you're emotionally out of balance and you respond, more than likely, you're going to do something very predictable. And when the hormones of stress are coursing through our circulatory system, you can guarantee there's always a gap between the way things appear and the way things really are. Our perception is altered. And during that emotional refractory period, if we act during that period, we'll always say the same thing. I should have never done that. I should have never said that. I should have never thought that. I should have never sent that email. Because it's those hormones that change who we really are. So if the hormones of stress create the emotions of anger and aggression and hostility and judgment and hatred and aggression and fear and anxiety and insecurity and hopelessness and powerlessness and guilt and shame, that's what the hormones of stress, when they affect us long-term, begin to wear the brain and body down. Then when we begin to look at those emotions and we realize that those emotions are pushing the wrong genetic buttons, then it comes time to begin to regulate our internal states, because a patient will walk into your office and they'll walk in with a certain health condition, and then you'll create more homeostasis and you'll release their innate intelligence in their body and they'll move back towards homeostasis. But then they'll go out into their life and they'll reinterpret their environment and react the same way. And for the most part, they'll show up 6 months later if they're not under maintenance care, and they'll walk in with the same exact problem, and they'll say, how did this happen? Well, you're reacting to the same people and doing the same things and re-experiencing the same environment in the exact same way, and for the most part, you're moving back into your past self. So when people begin to understand that, then they start to say, in the midst of their emotional reactions, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with emotionally reacting. It's just how long you react. Those chemicals, those 1,300 chemicals, last for the most part about 90 seconds to 2 minutes in the body. So if I tell my kids this all the time, if you're angry for more than 2 minutes, you're faking it, because you're keeping the hormones going, because those hormones are highly addictive. So teaching people how to regulate their emotional states and lower the volume to their reaction and shorten the refractory period of those emotions gives them a lot more freedom, because they're no longer looking at their life, you know, through the lens of those emotions. And so when people begin to understand that, they start to say, well, no one's worth it. You know, that I'm gonna get beyond this emotional state. And their body appreciates that. Justified or not, the emotions of stress, valid or not, always break the brain and body down long term.
You know, we have two different types of audiences on the line listening. We've got healthcare practitioners, and I think of the implication this has as a healthcare provider, you know, as a chiropractor, when people come to you and, you know, ask you questions about can you help me and so on, what impact the brain, the mind, your intention has on the results you get in the care and the way you speak to the people that you're working with. There's also the audience of those who are going to a chiropractor wondering, can they help me? Is this going to work? Or I've tried it for a period of time and I'm just not satisfied yet with the results. Or, you know, how much more of my life and lifestyle do I need to, you know, take responsibility for in order to be able to get the results that I'm looking for? Because obviously a lot of people are skeptical. They've tried, quote unquote, a lot of different things. We'll call it in the old model, perhaps. They get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And that actually happens both on the practitioner side and on the, whether you want to call it patient or client or person's level. Speak to that, Doc. How do we as practitioners and patients or wellness-oriented clients use this to our advantage?
Well, it's very simple. In an age of information, ignorance is a choice. We were talking about the medical model earlier, and it's basically breaking down, and it's breaking down because people are informed. 25 years ago, you went to the doctor, and she said, oh, you need your organ taken out, or you need this procedure, and most people signed on the dotted line and didn't think twice about it. Fast forward to today, person's diagnosed with a condition, the doctor gives them their options. Normally, it's one or two, and most people go home, and they get on the internet, and they research all of the different possibilities that are related to the diagnosis. And now they're informed, and they walk back in, and they create their own model of healthcare, and they say, hey, I want to try chiropractic, and I want to try changing my diet, and I want to start exercising. And sometimes the doctor says, well, I don't know anything about that, or that doesn't work. And now people are saying, well, time to find a new doctor, because I want a model of healthcare that's going to support me naturally. I don't want to live on drugs. I don't want to start with the most radical means of healthcare. So now, why is that important? Because it's up to the doctor to educate people and to begin to break the conditioning process down. That means then you don't need a flu shot because the pharmaceutical companies are saying you need a flu shot. That's conditioning. You don't need to believe in certain things that are out there because those things are dated information. So people are starting to wake up to that, and they're starting to become more aware, and that because of that, they're making different choices. The doctor who's on the call, who wants to have their clinic to be a resource of possibility, then it's up to them to educate people and educate them in those three realms, physically, chemically, and emotionally. And people want to hear that information. So then when we educate then, and patients show up in our office and they walk in feeling one way, they have to walk out feeling another way, either physically, chemically, or emotionally. And when that happens, the conditioning process begins. In other words, the moment they notice a change in their internal state, they feel better, they feel differently. They feel cared for, they feel educated, they see possibility. They'll correlate that internal change with that external environment that's called you. And if 45 to 50% of people that are diagnosed with cancer, and they're told that they're going to get nauseous after their first chemotherapy treatment, 40 to 50% of them get nauseous on their drive to their first chemotherapy treatment, then 40 to 50% of our patients can get well in anticipation in coming to our office. It's the same exact mechanism. And when you provide the environment and the resources and the knowledge for people to come and understand what they're doing, beyond just the chiropractic adjustment about lifestyle, about wellness, about managing their emotional state, and you have resources for them to choose from, oh, wow, you'll see them all of a sudden resonating and coming to your clinic because they want more. So that's the job of the doctor then, is to provide a base of education for patients to make the best choices for themselves. Now, the patient, on the other hand, who's trying to figure out if chiropractic healthcare works for them or all any modality, well, they have to be educated to the point where they assign meaning to what they're doing. In other words, the more you understand the why and the what, the faster the how happens. So I talk about it in my third book. If you take a group of Latin American maids and you watch these maids perform their daily activities, this was done by a few researchers, they found out that the maids that were cleaning the hotel rooms exceeded the Surgeon General's requirement for exercise. They saw that they were lifting mattresses and flipping them over and scrubbing walls and on their knees and pushing vacuums. And when they realized that they were exceeding the Surgeon General's requirement for exercise, they sat down with them and they divided them into two categories. The one category, they said, okay, just keep doing what you're doing. In the other category, they said, you know that exercise is good for your heart. Do you know that it helps you to burn body fat? It gives you a better lean body mass. It improves your self-esteem. It makes you stronger. And they just went through all the benefits of exercise. Now, these maids continued doing exactly what they were doing. They didn't change anything. But at the end of 1 month, they lost weight. They had less body fat. They had better self-esteem. They had more body strength. Why? Because they assigned meaning to what they were doing. So the more you assign meaning to your own care, and the more you begin to become aware of certain lifestyle choices, the better results that you get. So health is an ongoing thing. There's always more health to move into. The key is that when we get knocked out of balance because of our life throws a fastball at us, then our job then is to make our way back to homeostasis. And making those choices that have to do with natural and more alternative ways seems to be the most effective in the model that we're talking about.
Outstanding. As a neuroscientist, and you also went to chiropractic school as well. What do you think most people need to, when you talk about education, what do you think most people need to hear? You know, like you said, when explained that exercise has these potential benefits, what is it? What education do you think people need to hear about the benefits of chiropractic care?
Well, I think that there's a deprogramming that has to go on, because I think chiropractic stands on its own in terms of efficacy in taking people out of pain. Taking people out of pain is the first step, but when you're talking about creating chiropractic as a lifestyle choice, then tuning up your nervous system and keeping the flow of that intelligence moving through you, that's a vitalistic, or at least a neo-vitalistic point of view, where people are starting to say, wow, I'm connected to some greater intelligence, and that's what's really maintaining and sustaining my health and my life. And if I'm so out of balance that my autonomic nervous system is now calibrating itself in the wrong way, then by all means, then I have to start making some better choices for myself. So chiropractic is a great model and a great service that not only takes a person's pain away, but allows them to keep their nervous system flowing freely so that they can begin to express their life at a greater potential. So why chiropractic? Because what's the alternative? There aren't many alternatives where people really begin to see that their nervous system is going to be expressed at any greater level. So any chiropractor that's been practicing for any length of time, miracles happen in their office all the time. And we expect that because we understand how that intelligence works. So for the person who's choosing chiropractic care, if they find a right match with the doc that they feel supported by, then they get to participate in their health care, because lifestyle and changing behaviors and making different choices is really the new model. And I think that people really want to hear that more than anything else. So the first step is tuning up your nervous system. The second step then is you doing the right things to make sure that you're taking care of your body. And between the doctor and the patient, you have a great relationship to really reach the goals that you want to reach.
Outstanding. So we don't have a lot of time left, but I thought maybe as we kind of wind down and wrap up, what do you see as sort of a vision for the future of healthcare? I know if you look around with the Affordable Care Act and, the United States statistics health-wise relative to other nations, there's a lot of confusion. More of the conversation tends to be around the economics and disease treatment than it does the possibilities. What do you believe the picture or the potential picture looks like, or perhaps should look like, on a more collective level?
Well, I think there's a very strong intellectual division going on right now, Jason. I think that many people are going to hold on to the old paradigms, the old model. They're going to want someone to take care of them. That's fine, and that model has worked and sustained itself really well up until this point. The problem is that there aren't the proper resources and the proper systems to be able to take care of people that need being taken care of. But sooner or later, there's going to be people that begin to look at how they need to take care of themselves. And this kind of self-sufficiency that begins to emerge is going to become very selective. And those people will then begin to make the choices based on what they think is the best for them. And so I love this time right now, because it's really a falling away of the old. The paradigm is beginning to break down. And I love the fact that we're in this particular point in history, because in order for something new to emerge, the old has to die away, and we should never contract around this, and we should never be afraid of it, but we should stand up for what we already know. And I think that the more we educate people and the more we give people an alternative and the more we show them a better way of living, the more that division will begin to move towards chiropractic and other alternative means. So I'm not in the least bit worried about it, and I certainly think that people, if they find value in anything, they'll find the means to be able to make the right choice. So, great time to be alive. Great time to observed the old model beginning to crumble. And I think that if we continue to persevere, I think that people will begin to become more and more aware and not fall into that old model of, you know, someone has to take care of me, but I'm going to take care of myself and I'm going to make the right choices.
It becomes more of a relationship and teamwork as opposed to kind of parent-child type of a relationship. I agree with you. I think it's an extremely exciting time. In some respects, there's tremendous crisis going on, but of course that, as you've described on a personal level and even collectively, is really what opens up the field of opportunity for new things to emerge and grow, and I'm optimistic about that future as well. For those that haven't yet already, I really want to recommend you to buy Dr. Dispenza's new book, You Are the Placebo, Making Your Mind Matter. It's available at Amazon.com. It's available at Barnes & Noble, bookstores everywhere, New York Times bestseller. Dr. Dispenza, give us just sort of a summary of the book for those that don't have it yet so they know, you know, what is this investment, what are they going to experience with all of that?
Well, I mean, the reason I wrote the book is because if you give someone a sugar pill or a saline injection, you perform some false procedure or surgery, a certain percentage of those people will actually accept, believe, and surrender without any analysis that they're getting the verifiable treatment or the drug. So what happened there? I mean, they put their faith and belief in something outside of them, and it wasn't that external inert substance that healed them. They were being healed by thought alone. In other words, once that thought, fully embraced, began to become accepted, that's when it began to program their autonomic nervous system, and it was their autonomic nervous system that made its own pharmacy of chemicals to match the exact treatment or drug that they thought they were taking. And so then, if you understand the mechanisms of how the placebo works scientifically, and you can demystify it, the next question is, can you teach that? Can you teach a person, instead of putting their faith and belief in something outside of them, to put their faith and belief in something inside of them and begin to make that possibility a reality and move into the same state of being as if they were taking some external substance? And so the book is an exploration of some of the research that I've done to show that we've seen people heal themselves of some of the most amazing health conditions by regulating and changing their internal states. And I go to great measures, even showing some quantitative brain scans to show that people really did this. It wasn't just in their mind, it was in their brain. So the first half of the book is really about the science and the history and some great anecdotal stories about the placebo, a little bit about neuroplasticity and epigenetics, how to change the brain and body by thought alone. And then we examine what beliefs and perceptions are, because once we understand that in order to change a belief or perception, we have to literally change our state of being. We have to come out of our resting state. When people begin to understand that they have unconscious beliefs about money, about health, about relationships, about themselves, and beliefs are based on past experiences. So in order to change a belief or perception, you have to make a decision with such firm intention that the amplitude of that decision carries a level of energy that's greater than the hardwired programs in the brain and the emotional addictions in your body, and your body has to respond to a new mind. In other words, when you come out of your resting state and the choice that you make becomes an experience that you never forget, that's the moment you start rewriting the program. So we give people an opportunity then to do it. The second half of the book is about transformation, giving them the tools to be able to apply it and show them the way that we've done it over the last couple of years. And so there's a downloadable meditation that comes along with it and an exercise for them to practice. So knowledge is the precursor to experience. The more knowledge you have, the more prepared you are for an experience. So the book is divided in two halves. First half is the knowledge. The second half is the experience and the how-to.
Outstanding. And to take that to the next level, you also have workshops where people can, in fact, experience. Would you share with us about your workshops?
Well, the workshops really are an opportunity for people to retreat from their life just for a few days, to remove the constant stimulation of what reminds them of who they think they are, to eliminate the external environment and retreat into a new place. And we do these events called progressive workshops where it's a Friday night all day, Saturday all day, Sunday, and we give them a lot of content and they're changing beliefs and perceptions. They're tuning into potentials in the quantum field. They're getting a vision of their future. They're learning how to find the present moment. They're signaling new genes in new ways. They're reconditioning their body to a new mind. We have several different things that people practice. And for the most part, you'll leave there feeling very differently than when you arrived. My real passion, though, is the advanced workshops that we do around the world. And this is where we do the measurements. It's a four-day event, four full days in one evening. And we measure people's brains before the event, and we measure their brains after the event. We measure in real time certain people's brains during the event. We have them wearing heart rate monitors. We're measuring epigenetic changes in urine. We're measuring the energy of the room. Because the more we make the measurements of what we're doing, the more people understand how powerful they are. And when you begin to realize that you have this type of power within you and you can really interact with this intelligence within you, I've seen common people do the uncommon, and that's pretty exciting.
It's outstanding. I just want to say thank you so much for your work, for your inspiration, for really sort of putting the data and the science behind what many people perhaps don't believe or think is mystical or spiritual or not grounded in reality and real science. So you've really been instrumental, I think, for a lot of science and for a lot of professions in really making, substantiating the reality of what many of us intuitively know and quite honestly experience day to day, as well as an individual person, just kind of opening, again, my eyes up. I think a lot of the people I know who know you, have read your work, have worked with you, and so on, to really opening us up to the possibilities. It's a phenomenal story that happens to also be true. So on a personal level, I just want to thank you for that. For those of you that have been listening, I want to thank you for being a part of Amplified Live. For those of you that are amplifiers and who have shared this event as well as our daily great messages with your social networks, a sincere thank you very much for amplifying the message around the world. For those of you that are new to this program or may have received this message from somebody who has committed to amplifying our message of positive health and the chiropractic lifestyle, as many of us refer to it. Welcome. Thanks for investing your time here. I hope it's been extremely valuable. And Dr. Zisfenda, I'll give you the closing last words of what we should know and say thank you so much for really, as part of your very, very busy schedule, spending a few minutes with us and our audience for inspiring us and sharing with us what is possible.
Oh, thank you.
Final words.
And all I want to say is that I think it's a great opportunity for us to try it out. Try it out and see if you can measure the changes in your life by you at cause. And no one is so special to be excluded from this equation. And if we make time for our busy selves, just the hardest part about all of this is making time for ourselves. If we took a few minutes every day and we asked ourselves who we want to be when we open our eyes or how do I want to present myself to the world, and you made a decision to not get up until you felt and thought like that person, and you were able to maintain that modified state your entire day, something unusual is going to happen in your life. That's the law. And the beauty behind it is that enough people are beginning to do it, that it's becoming an accepted principle. I'm just excited to be a part of it.
That's phenomenal. Dr. Dispenza, it's been a pleasure. Thank you all for joining us here this afternoon, this evening, wherever you may be. Hopefully, we'll when things calm down for you, be able to continue the conversation and take it to the next level. If you haven't already, please, obviously, buy the book, enjoy the book. If you've already got the book and you love the work, then attend an upcoming workshop. It'll be life-changing, I assure you. Thanks for investing the hour with us here today. I really appreciate it. We look forward to having you at an upcoming Amplified Live event. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for listening. And Joe, thanks for sharing.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day, everyone.